Hello, everyone. Thank you all for listening in today. We are super excited to welcome today's special guest, Dr. Corsi Cruz, also known as Dr. Behavior. Dr. Cruz is a very accomplished behavior interventionalist and is here today to teach us about behavior. Welcome, Dr. Cruz.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Excellent. So can you tell us a little bit about what behavior intervention is?
Sure. In short, behavior intervention is just replacing a negative behavior with a positive behavior. And the way that we do that can be a couple of different ways. We do it by teaching. First and foremost, you have to know the skill that you need to learn. And then we coach it. So when you're kind of in the tough of things, we teach you about what you need to do and what you need to do next. And then we mentor later and we talk about how things worked and what you tried and how it worked. And if you were able to replace that negative with a positive. So that's basics of behavior intervention. It's pretty simple.
And how does a person become a behavior interventionist? Is there a specific course? Is there training? How does that work?
Oftentimes people will take extra courses or coursework. There are where they're developing more and more courses now where you can actually get degrees in that area. Previously, people would do social work, psychology. My two degrees are in criminal justice, and then my doctorate's in education. So I do have a lot of emphasis in psychology with my background as well. So it just kind of depends. More often than not, you get into a job where you need it, and that's how you learn it is usually what happens.
So you talked about having a background in psychology. Is that where you got the name Dr. Behavior from? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, kind of. So my last job previously to opening this business, I worked for Waco ISD. And part of the responsibilities that I took on was offering some professional development. And I was doing professional development at a school, and one of my co-workers who had been taking my classes for a few weeks was the one who got me to her school. She thought that her teachers needed some of the training. And so when she went to introduce me, she said, "Welcome, Dr. All Things Behavior." And so everybody kind of laughed, and that was that. Well, my boss happened to be there, and I did another training a few days later. And when he went to introduce me, he introduced me as Dr. Behavior. And so it just kind of stuck. And when I left the classroom and started thinking about opening up my own business, it made the most sense.
And so you kind of got that moniker because what you do is you come in there and you help teachers that deal with problem behaviors. Is that right?
Absolutely. So my career has been over about 22 years, and I've worked everywhere from prisons to residential facilities to crisis centers and to schools. And so my job is to come in when people are struggling and when there's an impasse and to get everybody back on track. The way I describe it is kind of like there is a train on the tracks and one of the cars falls off the tracks. You can drag it along for a while if you would like, but the train's not going to be the most efficient. So my job is to get that cart back up on the train tracks so that the train can continue on.
So kind of continuing on with that thought process, do you have typical questions that you get asked by parents or teachers, or is there like a line of questioning that you often get asked and you're like, "Oh, I got this"?
One of the questions that I get a lot is, "He won't listen. He won't listen. She won't listen." And the first question I always ask is, "Are you saying something they want to hear?" We tend to ignore the things that we don't really want to hear and the things that don't serve us. So that's the first question. The second question I always ask them is, "Are they looking at you?" If someone's not making eye contact, they're probably not listening to you. So it might be that you need to slow things down, stop what you're doing, and make sure that the person is looking at you before you start talking, and then you'll get a little bit better of a response. The other question that I get is, he acts up at school, but he never does it at home. He doesn't do that stuff at home. And my short answer to that is you probably discipline at home a little different than how we're able to discipline in school. And so that's the reason why we've got to change the way we react and respond to behavior. Fear-based discipline doesn't work long term. And so we've got to make some adjustments to that. But those are usually the two. He doesn't listen, or I keep getting calls from school, but he doesn't do that stuff at home. I don't know what to tell him. And the other short answer to that is partner with them. They need your help. They really need your help.
So that kind of brings me into my next question. You talked a little bit about fear-based discipline. So what should an adult do if they're struggling with a difficult child? And just touch a little bit on what fear-based discipline is as well.
Yeah, so fear-based discipline is because I said so. Because I'm bigger, because I'm stronger, and because I said so. a lot of us were raised with fear-based discipline. We were afraid of a whooping. We were afraid of when dad got home. We were afraid, you know, the phone call that mom was going to get that, you know, was going to relay down and trickle down. And so that's that fear-based discipline that I talk about. I have people all the time that say, I was raised like that and I did just fine. Well, yeah, because it kept you in fear. And so you never wanted to step outside of the fear. But what happens when the fear's not there anymore? There comes a point where we're not afraid. I can't tell you how many of my male friends have told me about that proverbial fight with their father, right? The day at 16 where he decided he had been lifting weights and he wasn't going to take it anymore. That's what happens with fear-based discipline. You get to a point where it doesn't work. And then you're faced with now what? So if you are a parent or a teacher or a leader who has always used fear-based discipline, it's all great and fine until it doesn't work. And then you're looking at the person trying to figure out now what. And so your choices are either you have to back off or you have to get more aggressive. And that's where people get hurt and that's where damage comes. So fear-based discipline might work for the interim. It doesn't work long term. The better suggestion is to connect. Bottom line is we don't learn from people we don't like. And so if you're trying to teach people how to do things and you're trying to encourage different behaviors, might I suggest that you be somebody likable? Because if I don't like you, I won't learn from you.
I think that's an important note, you know, that we don't learn from people we don't like. So, I mean, I can even think back in high school and going through college, there were professors who I absolutely despised going to their class on a daily basis. And then I can specifically remember, and I think everybody has a favorite teacher or a couple of favorite teachers, where you can specifically remember just being in that classroom and going to that class, and you just have such a fond attachment to that teacher because they felt you. They connected with you, and you felt heard by them. So can you tell us a little bit about what a parent or a teacher can do to kind of help make kids feel that connection?
Yeah, the first things first is you have to feel safe. If you don't feel comfortable with what you're doing, you've got to get some training and some support. And that includes parenting. That includes being a teacher. That includes whatever your role may be. If you're not comfortable, your body reacts to that. And there are some major deficits that you put yourself in when you're stressed. So the first things first is to create an environment that you're not stressed in. And once you create that stress-free environment, the people who enter into it should feel that same stress-free as well. So creating a safe environment is the first part. And then the second part is to actually care. If you don't care, they know. Everyone knows if you don't really care. We used to talk about when I worked at TYC, now TJJD, they could smell blood in the water. You know, it's so true. If you don't want to be there, if you don't like them, if you're not enjoying what you're doing, they know that, they feel that, and they're going to model that. Vice versa, if you love what you're doing, if you are safe and if you're comfortable and if you operate in a place with boundaries and with security, then everybody around you will as well. And that's from animals to children to adults to elderly. Everybody wants to feel safe. So for me, that's the foundation of everything I teach, is creating that safe environment.
Do you have any specific examples or sort of specific techniques that you teach new or even, you know, seasoned teachers or parents to use in their classroom or at home?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm going to step it even further back from that. The best advice that I can give anybody is to role model. Very best advice. When people talk to me about their kids and they tell me, you know, he doesn't know how to act when I go to the store, then take him to the store and teach him. He'll never know how if you never teach him. If you never take them, they'll never know. If you never take the time, they'll never know. So honestly, it really is modeling, coaching. Take your children everywhere. As teachers, explain the whys. The whys are so important about what we do. I mentioned earlier about that fear base, because I said so. Well, because I said so is the reason why I became a math teacher that didn't know how to teach multiplication, because I just knew my times tables. I didn't know that there was an actual like order that you were supposed. I didn't know any of that stuff. I just knew to, because they said so, we just do multiplication. And so my first year teaching, I was charged with teaching third graders how to multiply. I didn't, because they said so. That's why we do it this way, right? I had to learn that there were multiple algorithms and there were different ways to get to the same answer. And once I figured that out, I could provide four or five different options for students to learn. And whichever one was more important or more comfortable for them, they were able to utilize them. And so that's really the foundation for what I do with behavior. Different personalities do different things. I can't teach you a one-size-fits-all approach because your personality is different than someone else's personality. But I can teach you what to look for. I can teach you what to tell, what, how to notice that something's off, or I need to back off, or I'm doing too much, or, you know, I can teach you those things. Nonverbal communication is one of the number one things that we have as human beings. In normal functioning people, it's about 85% of our communication. And if you have ever had any kind of adverse childhood or adverse life experience, especially trauma and neglect, we know that that becomes 95%. So 95% of communication from kids and people from tough places is nonverbal. So it's really what, it's not what you say, it's how you say it in most cases. And it's the way that we choose to engage and interact that makes the biggest difference. A simple thing that I do with issuing discipline and consequences is I sit down when I work with children. I don't issue consequences standing up. I'm already in control and I'm already powerful. I don't need to show my authority in that way. Just my words are enough to do that. Contrary, if I have a safety issue in the classroom or in my home, the very first thing I'm going to do is stand and go to it with proximity and make sure that my ability to be there is felt, and so that people immediately know that help is here and that this is going to stop now. So, you know, something as simple as disciplining from a seat when a child is smaller than you is a great way to stay connected, because once that discipline's over, you're still connected and you're still expected to provide for that child, and that child's still looking to you. I always tell people, don't cut the head off of the snake, because the snake's coming back tomorrow, right? If you cut the head off, you're still going to have to teach that snake tomorrow. So I'd much rather have a full body and fully connected in order for us to kind of learn this stuff together. And so it's slow and steady, and it's a marathon, not a sprint.
And I think that's something that I've always been told growing up and going through the public school system is it's very much so a do as I say, not as I do kind of system. And what you're saying is contrary to that. It's about leading by example. It's about putting yourself on the same level as the child or the teenager that's having these discipline issues, and just really saying, hey, here's what I'm seeing. Let's have a conversation about it instead of trying to hold something over them in a power struggle.
Absolutely. When we do something wrong, we feel bad. We feel bad internally. We feel bad externally because of consequences and discipline and all of those things. We don't need to be beat down anymore. The fact is, once we issue those consequences, it's time to move on. Like I said, you can't annihilate someone and then bring them back tomorrow to try again, right? So you've got to give people something to work with. You've got to, I use the sandwich method whenever I give feedback. So I give a positive, I give the area that I think the person could use work on, and then I give another positive for encouragement. We really are fragile. We really are. And it doesn't take much for us to decide that you're unsafe and I don't like you. And so if my job is to get you to grow, then I have to partner with you and I have to give you those opportunities to do that. And that connection and that awareness is so important. And first things first, I have to be in control. In one of my trainings, I talk about the fact that an escalated adult cannot de-escalate an escalated child. Well, an escalated person can't de-escalate an escalated person. We don't get to take those liberties to decide those things. And so we have to be mindful of how we engage and how we interact with other people. And we have to stay in control.
I know you mentioned earlier a little bit about how when we communicate, a lot of our communication is done with our bodies, our nonverbal Absolutely. Communication. And the number that you gave us was 85%, but that increases to 95% if there's trauma. So can you tell us a little bit about how the brain and trauma interact and how these traumas are manifested by some of these adverse behaviors that we see in classrooms?
Yeah, it's our brain. our brain is our biggest champion, and it's also our biggest deficit at times. So we have a very primitive part of our brain that's designed to keep us alive. It's called the amygdala. The amygdala is that is at the base of your brainstem, and it really is the most primitive part. People refer to it often as fight, flight, or freeze. That fight, flight, or freeze response is there to keep us alive. So the job of the amygdala is to scan the area for threat. That's all it's doing is scanning the environment for threat. So if you've ever been in a conversation with somebody, say you're sitting outside at a cafe and there's a loud backfire, right? And one person jumps up to take off running, the other person freezes, and neither one of you can remember what you were just talking about, right? So that's an example of the amygdala. The same stressor, the same environmental stress happened, and two people experienced the exact same thing at the exact same time, yet had two very different responses. That's exactly what happens with the amygdala. So that's your amygdala that did that. You don't get to pick. The job of the amygdala is to keep you alive. And so in short, what's happening is your brain is scanning for threat, and it's picking up threat and it's reacting to it. So if you have a child that you're working with and they are obstinate all of the time, they're not feeling safe. It's very simple. They don't feel safe. And what happens initially when we don't feel safe, oftentimes we'll kind of shut down, or that freeze moment, right? Well, over time, if we feel that enough time, we can kind of push through and persevere through to decide after the fear that we're going to fight. And so that's where that fight response I've seen comes from children and other people. I've had just about enough of this. It's kind of the brain's way of saying, I'm sick of doing it this way. Shutting down and not talking is not working for me anymore. So next time you do that, I'm yelling at you. I'm going to yell at you the way you yelled at me. And so that's kind of the way that we fight through that fight, flight, or freeze response to get us to a different response. But neither one of them are ideal. We don't want to do either one of them. We literally are trying to survive a stressful situation that we can't control. And that's what is the most difficult thing for us to do, because I just want it to stop. And you won't stop. And that's where listening to people's words are so important. I encourage people all the time, use your words. And it sounds so simple, but we don't. We use our words to tell everybody else how we feel, but we won't tell the person that really upset us how we feel, right? We're great at picking up the phone or getting on social media or doing whatever to tell everybody else. But the minute that we're confronted with that person that makes us shut down, that fight, flight, freeze response, what do? We shut down. We acquiesce. We walk away. We run away. We don't even go to the meeting. We avoid it altogether. That's because our brain is anticipating an unsafe environment, and we're not feeling comfortable enough to handle it. What I do as a behavior interventionist is I give you the strategies so that when you get in those situations, because you will, you're a human, they will happen. When you get in those situations, you need to be prepared on what to do. One of the best tips and tricks that I teach anybody is to breathe. Just a deep breath. It settles your brain. It allows your brain to have oxygen when it's tensed up from that fight, flight, or freeze response, and it opens things back up. So your brain really is at the center of all of this, and it's all about its need to feel safe and to stay alive. And so it doesn't matter how ridiculous you look in your reactions. As long as you're alive when it's over with, it did its job. And so what we have to do is we have to learn how to make ourselves feel safe. We have to know when our brain is starting to trigger that we don't feel safe, and we have to use our strategies and learn those strategies so that we can calm ourselves down so we're not contributing to the problem.
And the whole time you were talking about the fight, flight, or freeze reaction, all I could do was picture myself being a teenager and saying, well, you don't understand me, Mom, or you don't get me, Dad. You know, just the idea of, you know, if you ever ask a teenager, and I'm sure our listeners out there have all experienced teenagers because they've been one themselves if they don't have one already, is just kind of asking your child, hey, how was your day today? And of course, you're always met with a fine.
Good.
Yeah, one word response. And it's interesting because what you're saying is it sounds like maybe they're experiencing some sort of distress. And even though they're saying they're good or they're fine or they're okay, to probe in maybe a different way, sit down with your kid and have a conversation about what's going on, even if it is, you know, fine, like they're saying it is, it's important for you to sit down and have that connection.
Absolutely. I only ask open-ended questions. So I don't ask anything where you can give me a one-word answer. And my stepson used to hate it when he would get home from school. I would say, what was one thing that you loved about school today? What was one thing that made you smile today? What was one thing that you learned that you didn't know yesterday? What's one thing you could teach me? Right? I ask these questions and it makes them reflect on their day. There's a chance that there's things that your child went through that they didn't know how to handle it, but they made it through, right? And it's over with. And because it was stressful and that brain shut down, they just don't even want to revisit it. But if you can ask a question in a safe environment that gets them talking about those things that are stressful for them, you can hear exactly what's going on inside their brain. If you listen to a child talk, you can realize just how misinformed they really are. If they're not actively being taught, they're trying to synthesize and take in and make sense of the world around them. They don't understand the depths of what we're dealing with as adults, just like we're not always aware, cognizant of the depths of the things that our kids are going through. If you remember being a child, you remember how lonely it was and how scary it was and how your friends were the smartest people on the planet, right? And so those are the things that we forget as adults, and just providing those opportunities to just talk and hear. When they tell you what they're thinking and it's wrong, you get to teach them the right way. You get to teach them what you want them to know, not what they've picked up or absorbed from their environment. That's where that communication and that conversation comes from. But if you're a person that wasn't raised with parents who communicated, it can be very difficult for you to do as well. Date nights are a great thing, male and female, you know, daddy date night, mommy date night. And that goes for male and female children. It doesn't have to be just men, just boys, just girls. Providing special time. We used to do family night on Friday nights where we would order pizza and watch movies. And that was just what we did. And everybody knew it. If we were home, we were going to be doing pizza night. And so we would anticipate what game we wanted to bring or what I want to get this soda, or I want to get this sweet. And people started getting excited about it. Our family was excited about it. Those are the things. It doesn't matter what you do. Just be consistent with it. Whatever you start, just be consistent. Be a consistent message in a world of messages that are so convoluted and are so wrong in so many ways. You be that message, because if not, the world's going to be it for you.
It kind of strikes me as funny in a way that some of this stuff directly applies to adults as well. You know, I can think about how coming in on a daily basis to work, if I'm not knowing what to expect, you know, having inconsistencies in my daily routine, I'm stressed.
Absolutely.
You know, and if an adult is stressed, how is a teenager going to feel, or how is a kid going to feel if they don't know what to expect the very next day or in class or at home? You know, I can see that.
That's a foundation for what I teach in my teacher training, is routine, keeping the routine. I also do circles, which we call are like family circles, family business. Circle time is a time for us to sit down and talk about what our day is going to look like. Every day we talk about, just for teachers, my circle time has three parts. The first part is the commitments to the rules or the expectations, or family values. We call them values. We're going to be respectful. We're going to be responsible. We're going to be safe. We're going to be helpful. And then we do highs and lows. And that's that opportunity for you to be able to talk about what's going well in your life, what's going good, or some things that you're not looking forward to. I've got a test coming up, or, you know, I just broke up with my girlfriend. I'm really stressed about it. Those are opportunities to be able to get more insight as to what's going on. And then you can provide those opportunities for own it, fix it. If somebody said something or did something to someone that hurt them or harmed them in some way, if you're feeling bad about something you said or did, it's a great time for you to say, hey, I want to talk to you about that conversation we had yesterday. I don't really like the way I handled that. Can we talk about that differently? And provide it a redo. Redos are one of your best things. Kids are amazed when an adult looks at them and says, I don't like the way I just handled that. Can I have a redo? And the kid's like, huh? I'm like, say what you just said again. Right? What do you do immediately? You take all of the difficulty, the drama, all of the things that are going on, you take it down. Huh? Because now, yeah, say what you said earlier. And the kid's like, what? Well, guess what's happening? You're calming yourself down as well. So then when the kid says, Dr. Cruz, can I go to the restroom? Yes, you may. Thank you for asking. Instead of me saying, what? I'm busy. You're not supposed to, right? So, can I get a redo? May I go to the restroom? Yes, you may. Or can you wait till I finish with this student? Right? that redo opportunity is not just a practice opportunity to say, oops, I messed up. It's literally a practice opportunity to do it different next time. If you never practice different, you'll never do different. If you've only done it one way and you're resistant to trying it another way, you are guaranteed to never do it the new way. It will never happen. You've never practiced it. How could you ever do it? You're not even willing to try. So as a behavior interventionist, that's my hardest job, is to get people to try, just be willing to even try the behavior or to try the new strategy.
Well, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because I'm thinking back to my grade school years, and I know that I mentioned that I had some favorite teachers and not so favorite teachers, but one of the things that I can remember about the teachers that I didn't like is that anytime that they would do anything, if it was an overreaction or if it was just flat out an incorrect statement, I remember that I would be so upset.
Absolutely.
Because they refused. They absolutely refused to correct themselves. And it could be something as small as, well, I didn't say that. I said this.
Yep.
You know, and the fact that this person was an authority figure and they were unwilling to yield or to be malleable and to correct themselves was just so frustrating to me as a child. And I think it's important to note that adults can be wrong.
Absolutely. We're wrong all the time. We're learning things all the time, too. Just because we've picked a major in college and a career that we've, you know, traveled down, we're still learning new things. And, you know, the pandemic taught us that, right? If you, as an educator, I wasn't comfortable with Zoom. I had never done Zoom before. Well, get ready. Here you go, right? So it's 1,000%. It's so important for adults to model owning responsibility. We want kids to own it. Fess up to what you did. Come on, tell me what you did. You better own it. Own it. Tell me what you did. The reality of it is we make excuses. We act helpless. We deceive. We downplay. We do all of those thinking errors that allow us to avoid responsibility because we don't want to have to feel bad. The bottom line is, if I can say, hey, I messed up, then you can't tell me I messed up. I learned a long time ago, because I'm a perfectionist about things, that if I own it first, then I can't get in trouble. I've never been written up at a single job I've ever had. And it's not because I haven't made mistakes. It's because when I screwed up, I went straight to my boss and said, hey, I just messed up. Can I tell you what I just did? And then I tell him what I did, and then I say, and then this is what I did to fix it, and I'm not going to do that again. Well, what else is there for my boss to say at that point? But okay. Don't do that, right? He may have me sign something that says I acknowledge I did it, but bottom line is it stops there unless I do it again, right? So if I can learn from my mistake, owning it is what allows me to acknowledge that it was a problem. I can't change what I don't acknowledge, that old Dr. Philism, right? You have to acknowledge it in order to change it. And it's so true. The tool that I use most is reflection. We talk when everything's said and done and we're in a safe environment, and we're eating some crackers and drinking some water. We're going to talk about what happened, and not from a you're in trouble and I'm a pow-pow you, but we need to know what just happened so we don't do that again. Did you like the way that felt? I didn't like that, Dr. Cruz. I didn't like that either. So can we try it different? Here, ask me again. I'm going to do it different. Here, I'm going to ask it different. That teaching and training of role modeling is priceless. Being able to walk through in a less stressed environment and actually have a chance to practice first, it's huge. It's one of the reasons why people hate public speaking, because you never get practice unless you're in public speaking, right? So you never get, that's where Toastmasters and some of those places come from. It's because fight, flight, or freeze is real and our brains shut down. And so if you get nervous speaking in front of people, that's exactly what you're experiencing. Well, guess what? The more you do it, the easier it gets, right? That's all behavior. All behavior. Public speaking is just a type of behavior. It's how it is for all of it.
In the classroom, what I'm hearing and just what I'm understanding is that basically what it boils down to, what behavior boils down to, and correct me if I'm wrong, because again, I'm not an expert in this field, but what it sounds like it boils down to is being able to be on the same level as your kids that you're working with or the teenagers that you're engaged with, being able to admit fault, but being able to say, hey, I'm wrong, but here's how we correct it.
Absolutely. It's an acknowledgement that we're not perfect. That's really what it is. I'll tell you, the number one issue that I think that we face as human beings is anxiety. And anxiety is a worry. It's a stress. It is a what if. It's really what it is. Anxiety is a what if that just goes over and over and over in our heads, over and over and over and over again. And if you're not careful, it becomes pervasive and it's all you hear. And that what if is the foundation for that amygdala uh-oh response. Uh-oh, there's a threat. Uh-oh, I have to react. Uh-oh, I have to respond. And the bottom line is when you're reacting instead of responding, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. The reaction is what gets you in trouble. And so understanding first what people are going through, having human compassion is central. While you look really stressed out, your face is all contorted, your fists are balled up, you're breathing heavy. Did something happen that made you angry? Are you upset? Ask the question. As humans, we don't know everything. I know it's shocking, but we really don't. The more questions we ask, the more knowledge we gain. So if you're working with someone, it doesn't matter the age, ask questions. Hey, you don't seem like yourself today. Are you okay? Hey, is something bothering you? They're short with you and they're snippy and they're, you know, slamming things around. Hey, can I do something to help you? Did I do something to bother you? Would you rather me leave you alone? You know, you asking those questions are so important to get to the root because we think we know everything. Dr. Behavior used to think she knew everything. I can pick up behavior patterns all day long until I'm wrong. So rather than assuming, and we know what that does to everybody, let's just ask the question. Hey, are you upset? Not why are you upset? I'm not upset. Right? Just ask questions. Hey, did something happen today? Hey, what was the best part of your day today? Right? When someone knows you care, you would be amazed at what they're willing to not only give you an information, but do for you in life. That connection is, it's innumerable. I can't put a dollar amount to it. And it literally is the secret to my success. I connect and I connect well with people.
And so just to kind of summarize what you're saying is to ask questions from a point of compassion and caring. Right? We want to make sure that we show empathy towards somebody because at the end of the day, telling somebody how you feel is being vulnerable.
Absolutely.
And everyone knows that being vulnerable is not easy.
That's the biggest strength. That has been my own personal evolution. My personal evolution as an individual has stemmed from vulnerability and transparency. If you have me on social media, I talk about all kinds of stuff and I'm honest when I struggle and I'm honest when, you know, I'm working through something difficult. I put it out there. That vulnerability and transparency is so important because we all walk around thinking we're the only ones and we're not. Everybody's going through something difficult. If I were to kind of sum all of this up in behavior intervention, I'd like to kind of describe it this way. Think about this idea or this myth that kids are born bad, okay? So we have this idea that kids are born bad. I want you to think about behavior in terms of a diagnosis, right? And so for the first part of this example, I'll give you diabetes. So if a person's born with diabetes, that is a nature issue, that's a biological issue that they're coming into the world with. If that behavior, diagnosis is not nurtured, then bad things happen. If it is nurtured, we regulate insulin, we're checking blood sugar, we're exercising, we are modifying what we eat, those things, then that condition is improved because of the support and the things that we're offering it. If we don't provide those things, the lifespan of that person is going to be very short, right? We know that if you don't manage diabetes, it can kill you. If you take that same example in behavior, there is a nature component to aggression in some people, in some children. We see it in the brain. There's higher reactivity, and so there's theories about what that happens. But bottom line is, as a behaviorist, I do care where it comes from, but first and foremost, I've got to stop it. Right? So that nature component could be biological. It could be from stress hormones. It could be from a neonate exposure to trauma. It could be a car wreck. It could be all kinds of things that cause this issue, right? But for whatever reason, the brain is coming into this world with a higher than normal level of aggression. And so if we provide the supports, if we provide the teaching and the training, if it needs medication, as in ADHD or some of the other behaviors that we often see in schools and that sort of thing that affect children, if we treat those things with therapy, with support, with modeling, and with coaching, then that inherent nature trait now has been affected, and that person can manage a very healthy and long lifestyle with it. If aggression comes in and we don't treat it and we don't support it and we don't manage it, then it too can shorten a person's lifespan. And I hate to say that, but at the alternative school, we lost 6 kids in 18 months to murder. 6 of our former students over during the pandemic, we lost to murder. If these behaviors aren't fixed, there are consequences to them. And so being willing to admit that you're not good, but seeking out help to get better is really the case, because yes, you are partnering with those students and you are understanding where they're coming from, but they're looking to you as the adult to help them manage a chronic issue that they don't know how to deal with. And so if you don't, if you turn your hand, then you become that doctor that's refusing to prescribe the prescription. And that's detrimental to people's lives. So that's where really the doctor behavior came from, is I want to teach people how to do this better, because I see the consequences of what happens to children and to people who aren't receiving the medication and the support and the strategies that they need in these situations.
So on that note, where can we go to find out a little bit more information about doctor behavior for people that want to learn more about how to be more effective in communicating with their children or with their students? Where can we go to learn a little bit more about how to improve our behavior intervention techniques?
So right now I'm in kind of my upstart process. You can find me on social media. Corsi Cruz is where you can find me, CORSICREWS. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram. I'm working on my TikTok presence right now. I'm kind of doing a whole marketing thing on that from a doctor behavior standpoint. You can also reach me via Gmail right now at CruzCorsi@gmail.com. I'm working on my website, so there will be two, wayofcorsicruz.com and drbehavior.com. They'll be linked together and you'll be able to kind of find all things behavior in that particular area. And so social media is the best way to get me, or through email. I do offer private trainings, professional developments. I do leadership trainings. It's not just for teachers and parents. My background is in leadership. And so I do some really great work with leaders and becoming more servant leaders, being more connected to the people that you work with and the people that you're charged with leading, creating that safe working environment, all of those things that we know settles the brain and gets better production. So I do different professional development trainings in those areas. And I'm also writing my book right now, which I'm super excited about. Hopefully that's going to be out after the first of the year. It's called The 21st Century Human: Cool, Calm, and Connected. And so those are the projects that I have coming up on the next step.
And are there any shout outs you want to give a thanks to, like a special teacher or any events that you have coming up that you wanted to let our listeners know about?
Yeah. So my team over at Wiley, the Wiley Alternative School, is kind of my shout out group. We started over at Wiley all together. I was a brand new teacher and my coworker was a brand new teacher, and we started our classroom. I kind of put together what I had learned and put it into a classroom, and we did a tier 3 intervention program as a tier 1 intervention. So instead of only certain kids get certain interventions, all kids got all interventions no matter who you were in that classroom. And we developed that program over the last 4 years. And so one of my best friends has taken over my job in that. And so she's running with that program. So I definitely want to give them shouts out, because educators are really struggling right now, y'all. We need all the help you can, all the help we can get. And then the next thing that I'm super excited about is I've partnered with McLennan Community College here in Waco. We are going to be offering doctor behavior courses, and they're going to be open to the public. And so anybody's going to be able to come. I will have teacher trainings. I'll have parent trainings. I'll have leader trainings. Next week on November the 11th, I actually have a teacher training coming up at MCC. It's called Let's Talk Classroom Shop with Dr. Behavior. And so that's coming up next week on November the 11th. It'll be a four-hour training from 8 to 12. We are offering CEUs through the college. And so you can register through the MCC website, or you can contact me, and I'm glad to send you that link. So we have those coming up, and then I've got a couple of courses planned in the spring with them. And as the need arises, we'll create and offer more. So, you know, as people need it, we will come.
And that's wonderful. So I just wanted to say thank you again, Dr. Cruz / Dr. Behavior, for joining us today. Before you go, is there any last minute bits of advice or tips you wanted to give our listeners about behavior intervention?
I just will kind of hit you with my tagline. My tagline is connection cures. Dr. Behavior, connection cures. The connection that you have with other people, staying in the fight when it gets tough, those are the things that people remember when it's all said and done and they look back. Not what you wore, not how much money you made, but the fact that you stood by them during a really tough time. And for kids, there's a lot of tough times. So just stay in the fight and just remember, connection cures.
Thank you again for being with us today, Dr. Cruz.
Thank you for having me.